How are you?
Hi, Mary. How are you this evening?
Good, good. All ready for the meeting, right?
Good.
Yeah.
Hi, Diane. Hi,
Hi,
Diane.
how are you? How
How are you?
are you both? Doing good.
Good. All ladies. We're
Yay.
the first ones here.
Yeah.
Who run the world?
Mary, where are you from? Are you I'm in South Carolina right now.
South Carolina? Okay, I knew you were far away. Yeah. Hi, Dave.
Evening.
Hi,
Hi,
Dave.
Dave.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. Nice day out there today.
Yes, it's been nice.
Yeah, tomorrow's going to be a leaf blowing day, I think, before the rain again.
I've been working on my leaves forever. I've done 12 hours of raking.
My God.
Oh my
Oh,
God.
really?
Oh.
Yeah, and I'm not done yet.
Wow.
Yeah. At least I have a place to put them. I put them in the back in the woods and then in my front yard. It's really long, so I put them in the woods in the front yard. So it's good. It's the driveway that's hard.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I just blow them off the edge of the property, but that they keep piling up. So you have to, the pile gets so high, you have to shrink the pile, and it just goes on and on. So.
Yeah. Sure does look nice though when there's you're not wading through leaves. They were
Right,
up to
right.
my shins.
Oh my gosh.
There we go. So I didn't make Kakiwik. Did anyone go? I didn't.
I didn't
I
make
did.
it
Did
either.
you?
I went and Ross and Michael were with
Yeah.
me.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, hi,
Good.
Jim.
Hi,
Good.
Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hi.
Yeah, I'll talk about Kakiwik more in my agent report. It was fantastic. I had the best time.
Oh,
Oh,
really?
good.
Good.
Yeah,
Yeah. I
I'm
haven't made it yet.
glad.
Next year. Yeah.
Yeah, you should go. It's really great.
Good.
It was a
How
lot.
much? You got to be kind of picky about what you see, though, right? I mean, there's only so much.
Yes.
There's a lot going on at once. Is that
There is. Yeah, I wanted to clone myself four times and see all of the sessions.
right?
But I ended up mostly going to the regulatory ones. Like there's a couple different tracks.
Okay.
Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi,
Hi,
Michael.
Michael.
So yeah, there's a few different tracks you can sort of you can go to any of them. You don't have to stick with a track, but there'll be a track for people who are more interested in climate, and then there was like a
Okay.
wildlife track, and then there was more of like a wetland agent
Okay.
regulatory track. So that's the one I did.
Wow.
And that was fantastic. But
Oh, cool.
I hope you don't be offended by Jack. He likes to come on Zoom.
Oh no.
No.
He's
Oh,
already
Jack.
up here trying to find his way over to
Oh,
Beck.
it's
I'm so glad I know his name
welcome.
now. I've seen him before.
So you have a wildlife one too? I would have liked that.
Yeah, there was like I have it right here actually. There's Track A was assessing and preserving our varied habitats, their wildlife and inhabitants. Track B was application, evaluation, enforcement, and wetland regulation. That was the one I did. Track C was increasing climate resiliency and other emerging threats. And track D was helping our commissions evaluate and respond to evolving threats and other issues.
Oh,
So,
wow. That is a
yeah, so
lot.
yeah,
A lot of really
habitat,
good ones.
climate, enforcement. Yeah, it was great.
The term track, does that mean there were subsequent meetings in, along that one in that certain area or?
Yeah, so it was
Okay.
basically there were three different like workshop sessions.
Okay.
So you might be able to see it there.
Okay. Yep.
So you could do the three workshops, there were four concurrent workshops going on at any given time. And so there were three, basically there were 12 sessions in total, four workshops going on at any given time for three sessions. So for like the tracks wouldn't overlap with each other, basically.
Okay.
The wetlands ones would be taking place at like different times, so you could see them all.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh, cool.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Did you all carpool together?
No, I went myself. My executive director at the conservation district. So I sort of got sent from both sides. I'm not sure how familiar y'all are with what I do besides Bolton.
No.
No,
a lot of people don't know, but I'm only subcontracted into Bolton for like 6 hours a week.
Oh.
I usually spend more than 6 hours, but I'm supposed to do like 6 hours. And but my main job, the job I spend 34 hours out of my week at, I'm a natural resource specialist with the North Central Conservation District.
Oh, wow.
So Bolton is within the North Central District. So we provide technical assistance to any residents within 30 or so municipalities in like the greater, like northern central region. That makes sense because we're the North Central Conservation District. But yeah, we go all the way out to like Granby area and all the way over to like just before Storrs and then down pretty much to Hartford and then up to the border. So that whole section we cover, and we do grant funded projects. We provide residents with environmental assistance, anything like that. So yeah, that's what I do for the bulk of my week. And then Bolton, I just get some of my hours contracted there.
Wow. So how did we luck out? Kidding you.
Oh, thanks. I mean, Cam did the same thing. So Cam was okay. Also, he had my same exact position and his, it's just how the position's designed. I came in knowing that. So it was, it's
oh.
Nice to have that sort of, you know, mix up in my week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Thanks.
Mm.
Well, yeah, thank you for serving on with us on Bolton.
Oh, of course, I'm beyond happy to. I absolutely love this town. But yeah, if any of you need any sort of environmental technical assistance with something in on your property or something like that, the North Central Conservation District can provide support. So
okay, great, good to know. Thank you, Alyssa.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. Hi, Ross.
Hello.
So hi, Ross.
I'm going to start by saying that I've known Diane for like about 15 years, and I've been calling her Diana for all of that time. And she finally told me, no, my name is Diane. I don't know why you're calling me Diana.
That's all right.
Met her like one of my first weeks here in Bolton. She's out walking and said hello, and she walked by my yard. And for some reason, I've been calling her Diana, even though she is Diane. So
that's
I
thought okay.
I would make that official acknowledgement today.
It's okay, Ross. It's only a letter.
Okay, so let's get started. I'm going to look and see if we have any public comment, and I don't see any public to make comments today. So we can move on to our approval of minutes of our October 22nd regular meeting.
Make a motion to accept the meeting.
Actually, I had one comment. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
So do you want to make the motion and then we can have discussion and change
it? Oh, is that how it works? Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, well, normally technically you make the motion to approve, then you have any discussion, and after the motion's, you know, seconded, and then you can go and make the comments, and then we can approve it with, you know, the suggestions that were made. So do I have a second on that? Because then, Diane, you made the motion.
Mm-hmm.
And do we have a second?
A second.
Okay, so second by Michael. So discussion.
So There was just a small spelling thing.
Diana instead of Diane.
I was going to say
not
that.
That one. It was the spelling of Snarsky. I know that's tough to just hear and spell, but it's Snarski. I believe it was spelled Snarskey, but it's Snarsky with an I at the end.
Good Polish name.
Yeah, I don't know if that's important, but I just noticed that. That is.
I'll make that change in tonight's minutes with reflect, going back to the October meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
I'm just reading. Yeah, it was Snarskey in the minutes. So, yes, that is. That should be all from me.
And I don't see anything else. Does anybody have any other questions, comments?
Not for me.
Nope.
Okay, then I'll entertain a vote. So all those in favor of accepting the minutes with the changes, the changes that were, suggested tonight, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes with those changes. Okay, we can move on. We have no old business, no new business, so we can go right to the wetland agent's report.
Yes. Yeah, so obviously we didn't have any applications new for this month, but I still wanted to meet because I felt like we have a lot to talk about. Not too much. It won't be like a very long meeting, don't worry. But so for my agent report, just start. So 310 Hop River, which is a property owned by someone named Mike. I am blanking on his last name right now. I only write my my addresses here, so I can't remember the owner's name. Anyway, it's 310 Hop River. He had a permit that got approved in 2020. I believe it was June of 2020. It was a permit to demolish an existing structure and rebuild it in a slightly different orientation, just moving it over and kind of twisting it a couple feet. So that got approved by this commission in 2020. Never started, assuming because of COVID and, life things happening. So he was going to restart that, the endeavor of that project. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, he's going to have to come back because it was 4 years ago. The permit must be expired. But it's actually during a period from about March 2020 to June 2021, all permits that were approved during that time actually have an extension of 14 to 19 years. So his is a 14-year extension. So that permit's good for 14 years. So he's not going to have to come back. He still, of course, is going to have to alert me and everything when he's starting the work. But I just wanted to let y'all know so you don't see work happening and are confused why it didn't come through you.
As long as he doesn't deviate from those plans,
yeah.
He doesn't have to come back. If he does deviate from them, then he would have to come back and do an amendment to his existing application.
Yep. Yeah. So it seems like it's just going to be the same exact thing. So, but I'll talk to him just to touch base.
So I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't have to do anything for... He doesn't have to work on the property?
What do you mean? He doesn't have to...
Isn't
you're questioning, like, If you get a permit, do you have to actually do anything? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Permits, once you get them, the completing of the work is voluntary.
Okay.
So you don't have to do anything with it. You could get the permit and spend the money on that and design and whatever, and then never do anything.
Okay.
That's, and then you can start years later, as long as the permit is still in effect and you're not deviating from it. You would just let the current wetlands agent know.
Yeah.
Okay, so he has up to 14 years to
Yeah.
decide whether he wants to work on
Correct.
getting it completed,
Correct.
whatever his,
But
okay.
typically,
If he starts the project, like he strips
right.
all the vegetation, then he's required to comply with the permit and insofar as sediment control and any other permit requirements for that different phase of the project. But he doesn't have to necessarily complete it. So depending on what he does, if he doesn't start at all, he doesn't have to do anything. If he starts it, he has to make sure he adheres to the plans for the various phases of the project.
And then to your point too, he could stop at any point as long
Yep.
as thing,
As
as long
long,
as whatever he's done is stabilized.
yeah. And so if he maintains, either stabilize or maintains the sediment control system.
Has he started anything?
Not yet. He
Okay.
hasn't started. He was just sort of coming back to the town to figure out what he needed after that that sort of time period where he wasn't doing anything. And typically it would be permits are only good for, we do 2 years, but some towns do five. It's around 2 to 5 years in the statute. But only because he did it during that period of COVID where there was a state of emergency declared, the governor said that all of the permits approved during that specific time during the state of emergency are to be extended 14 years.
That's quite a long
It's a
time.
very long time. I think
Yeah,
it's excessive, but the
yeah.
governor. Yeah, it's 14 years.
Somebody probably had a friend who had something that they couldn't get done for whatever reason, and it gets turned into something for COVID, but whatever. I'm
Yeah,
just
exactly.
a little bit cynical sometimes.
Something that would take 13 years.
Yeah, it seems
Yeah,
excessive to me.
me
That's why
too.
that's why I asked.
I know, me too, completely. I think 14
Yeah.
years. I definitely see things being extended till the state of emergency is over, and even for a couple of years after that, but 14 to 19 years is,
Yeah, that's
I don't
crazy.
understand the
It's
point, honestly.
one of those things that we don't understand it. They had some reason for doing it, and we're stuck with it.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah. Okay.
I think one thing they did wrong is because the statutes say 2 to 5 years for just normal wetland and inland wetland permits, but it's actually 10 years if it's affiliated with a zoning application, or there's three other categories where it becomes 10 years if it's tied in with those other applications. So the 14 years probably offshoot shot from that, so it's
Right.
not as long, but they completely wiped out the 2 to 5 year thing and just made it all 14. So
Wow.
yeah, if they had made the 2 to 5, maybe 4 to 8, that would have maybe been more reasonable, but they didn't. They just
Or extended by the length of the emergency declaration
exactly.
or
Yeah.
whatever.
And to be fair, also there was some uncertainty, who knows that the
And then it
pandemic
would
could have been followed up by a major recession or even depression. I mean, nobody knew that going into the pandemic, so
That's true. That's
Right.
true.
yeah. And
Yeah.
the only I was going to say one of the disadvantages to having such a long time frame is that conditions surrounding the site may change in such a way that, if we had gotten it later, the conditions we'd look at it and say, yeah, this isn't going to really work. So that's the disadvantage to this, but there's nothing we can, do about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Okay.
okay. So moving along. So I went to do a final check at 1079 Boston Turnpike, our friend Frederick Davis, who had come for a sub-driveway culvert project. It looks absolutely fantastic. He did such a
Oh.
fabulous job with it. It looked perfect. He was able to extend the driveway a bit so that he could bail into it if he needed to get off 44 quickly, which was great. And that's all stabilized. And then, yeah, it just looks great. There's some riprap down the trench, and it's still super vegetated. Like, he didn't remove much vegetation at all. And it just looks great. You can tell the waterway is just like,
And I would just encourage folks, if you get a chance, to drive by and take a look, as I have. And if you can go slowly by to just, admire the work, because he really did, a fantastic job with it.
Yeah, that's what I wish every project ended up looking like. But he was very happy to be, I think, absolved of it, because he really cared about the work, and was upset that he perceived that he had done something wrong at first. So so I was really happy to sort of like give him that final check, like, it looks awesome. So it was very,
I remember him talking about it, and he was genuinely concerned, and you could tell he felt like, oh my goodness, I just want to do the right thing.
And he did. He did the right thing.
Oh, that's great. Everybody had that attitude.
This is one of those things where there's like a technicality of what he should have done before he started work, but he did more than what most of our clients would do, who are given, who come in and take the initiative of seeing us before they do anything. So it's one of those, like, why be petty about something? It doesn't make any sense when the guy did a really good job to make good on what he started.
So that one's good. I have 180 Bolton Center, which is a single family residential unit right on Bolton Center Road, like 2 minutes down from the town hall. That one has been sort of, they'll work on it for a bit and then they'll stop for a couple months. It'll be left unstabilized. Silt fence will deteriorate and then they'll work on it again. It's just sort of one of those. So I went out and met the gentleman who owns the property and spoke to him directly instead of through email. And
so this is 180, you said?
Correct. 180 Bolton Center. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
I thought you said it's two units. I thought it was one, a single family.
Yeah, single family residential. I might have said two.
That's what threw me off, because I'm saying I thought it was single family residential. Two units. Okay.
Correct. Yeah. Single family residential. I spoke to Dave Sposito, I believe his name is, and just was able to talk to him, sort of get a better gauge on what's going on the site. I actually drove by today when I was in Bolton, and the septic looks like it was being dug today.
Yeah, because I went by, they had a backhoe doing some trenching along the left side of the property as you face it from the street.
Yeah, that's the section that the septic is going in. And then the driveway also got poured, it looks like, so. Definitely some progress finally happening there. So I'm going to make sure that it's stabilized once that septic is dug, because there's some stockpiling of soil right now that's unprotected. So I'll make sure that that's all taken care of, but it's nice that there's some active work happening there again. So this was an interesting one. This was actually, let me go with the ones you guys have already heard of before jumping to that one. We'll do 148 Brandy. This one was an in-ground pool. This was delegated to me as an agent permit, so I don't even know if I have to tell the commission, but I like to keep you guys involved. There were some issues with that. There was silt fence was not properly installed. There was some soil that got placed where it shouldn't have been. So I spoke to Brian, the property owner, and he fully went out and fixed it. He fixed it within a couple days. So I didn't end up having to issue a violation there, which is good. I always try to give folks a chance before jumping to issue a violation. So when they cooperate, that's always good.
He came to talk to us too, didn't he?
Yeah, he just got approved, I believe, two meetings ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he, yeah, but at that meeting, it got delegated to me. So he hasn't been back. But yeah, so I sort of was working with him because there were some things that were definitely off permit there. So we were able to kind of resolve that, which was good.
That was mostly moving the stockpile area from one location to another. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't anything that we had approved him having a stockpile and stabilizing it and so forth, but he moved the location without checking first.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, it was still near wetlands, still needed the same thing. It was just in a different location.
Correct. And this different location was near and somewhat on his septic leach field. So I contacted the sanitarian about it because he never told the sanitarian that he was moving the location either. So I contacted the sanitarian and the sanitarian looked into it and he said it's completely fine. So he said you could put up to 8 feet of fill in that area and he wasn't nearly at 8 feet. So yeah, all is good there.
Yeah, I happened to run into him at early voting. He showed up and it was actually at the polls at St. Moore's that he showed up and thanked us, thanked me and the commission for working with him.
Mm. Yeah.
I just thought I would pass that on.
Mm. Yeah. And then, so this is one that you guys haven't heard of yet, and this isn't an application or anything, but I was driving around and noticed that there was some brush kind of located in a wetland. So it looked like there may have been some like chopping down of some shrubs and placing of the chopped shrubs into the wetland. So I also noticed a drainage pipe that was sort of it was unknown what the water source was. So I just was looking at that. I got some pictures and then I contacted the property owner just saying, hey, you're not supposed to do this. You can't put brush in wetlands, and also asked him what the source of the water was. And he had no idea that they were wetlands at all. It wasn't particularly obvious. It wasn't like it was a bog. It was a small isolated wetland that had no standing water at all. So most people wouldn't know that it's a wetland, so couldn't fault him at all.
Especially this fall, it's so dry.
Exactly, yeah, it's certainly very dry. Right. So yeah, he said it was just driveway runoff that the pipe was for, and that he would cease any further cutting or dumping in the wetlands, and he would remove what was there already. It wasn't anything I was terribly worried about, but just one of those things where I'm like, hey, these are wetlands, you shouldn't do this. So that was all. He was super cooperative. So that happened. And then that's for last.
You seem to be instilling the fear of the Lord into these people.
Yeah. I know. I try not to.
It'd be nice after you have a few words with them.
Right. But yeah, no, he was very, very cooperative. So that was good. And then this I am very happy about. So 65 Shoddy Mill. I wanted to save the best for last.
I was going to say, before you call it last, I got a couple of others to talk about afterwards. So,
oh yeah, we can
continue
do that
with Shoddy Mill.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to put, bless you.
Thank you.
I'm going to put a couple of photos if I can. I thought I was going to be able to do this more directly. All right, let's see if I can. So I went out to Shoddy Mill today and I wonder if I can't put photos in the chat.
You should be able to just click the share and the green share. if you have them up on your screen.
Oh, yeah, I can just share my screen. That's what I'll do. If I ever open. Okay. So it's just two photos that I have. But everyone see that?
Mm-hmm. It's coming. Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Cool. So this is what Shoddy Mill looks like now. That's a different project. But so this is the wetland restoration. So of course it doesn't look like much of a wetland right now, but if I zoom in over here, you can see under that rock how much fill got removed. That is a very, very large boulder. It's the scale is off because it's I'm taking it from way up on a on the slope, but that is a massive, like multi-ton boulder, and that's probably 2 feet of fill underneath it. So you can sort of gauge there how much fill got removed from the surrounding area.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So this all got, all of the fill got taken out. You can see there's still some fill underneath this line of boulders as well. Mm-hmm. But all of this is that native material that should have been there in the first place. And then this is that slope. They did a great job with it. This was the slope we were all concerned about with the compaction and all of that. So this is what they ended up doing with it. And it looks great.
So I presume they're going to put something down over that to prevent any erosion should we ever get rain.
Yes, there is. There's winter rye down on it. The seeds, I was walking through the seeds today. So it's seeded with winter rye right now. Thursday we should get some rain. So
I guess my question would be, is that sufficient? Because before the winter rye grows, if you get a heavy rain, you know, you're going to get some scouring and washing out of stuff. Just I'm just concerned just because of the you know, these are really intense storms we've had.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so they were mentioning that especially on the slope, it's in the plan and in the budget, if need be, that they would use erosion control blankets, like jute mats.
Yeah.
So that I know is sort of in their arsenal if they need it.
So did they hydro seed this with that cellulose mixture, or what did they do? Because sometimes if they do the hydro seeding, I think it's got cellulose or something in it, and that helps to hold the soil in place.
Yeah, definitely. I think that would be good. But no, this is just, they've just basically sprinkled and raked in some winter rye. And George wants to do, after the first hard frost, he wants to start some dormant seeding, but in like the basin area. So as for the slope, I think they're just going to do matting if it comes to that.
That's fine. I just get concerned that after you go through all this trouble,
right,
it gets, you know, to get depositions out of the wetlands is, let's not have it happen again.
Right. Yeah, I know that'd be terrible, but
what does winter rye look like when it's grown?
I think it's just kind of like a short. Oh, I can't. Ugh.
It's an annual.
The bar is blocking me from looking.
It's an annual. The rye grass grows very quickly, and so it's good to get
something
like... right away. But it's not. It doesn't last. And like Ross said, it's an annual. So right. It's only good for one season.
Okay.
Which is good, because if you can get that down to hold that, then at least you got the roots in the ground and everything to help stabilize stuff.
Okay. I can reshare. This is what winter rye
looks. Oh.
So it would probably look more like this one.
So that will
grow until
the first hard frost?
No. So this winter rye should seed and sprout now. Like especially hopefully with rain coming on Thursday, we should get some sprouting there, but the dormant seeding that I was mentioning, that's what George wants to do with the actual wetland plants, like the plants that are going to stay there and grow there. He wants to start dormant seeding those, after the first hard frost. So he's going to be doing some seeding with an approved seed mix from New England Wetland Plants. It's like the detention basin mix. Yeah. There's some great stuff in there. Little blue stem, red fescue, like all the great native erosion control wetland plants that we like are in there. So he's going to be doing some with that seed mix and then some by hand. I know he's going to be like specifically planting some things that he wants to see in there. I don't know if he mentioned like highbush blueberry, but I'd like to see that. That's for sure. But yeah, so.
Thank you.
To that. Let's see if I can stop sharing. So yeah. That 65 shoddy. I was honestly shocked at how much progress they had made in just really a week. I was out there last week, I think, and they had scraped off a lot of the fill, but there were still several inches in some areas and probably even up to a foot in some. They were sort of working from innermost to outermost. So there was still quite a lot of fill, and the slope was not completely made up yet. There was still like a section of raw slope sort of up to the highest point. So it was, I was shocked at seeing the slope fully done. And yeah, I was very happy with how it turned out. And I was down there poking with my auger, making sure that there was no, that the fill wasn't being occluded by other soil kind of covering it, so it didn't look filled. I was poking in and making sure there was no fill left, and there was some mixing at the top. So the very top of the native horizon, what was there before the fill, sort of mixed up a little bit with the fill. So there's like a slight, like maybe 10% fill sort of mixed in with that very top layer, well, which is
kind of hard to avoid anyway. Exactly. This kind of work.
Right.
Exactly. Nothing other than stripping off stuff to leave, which is you don't really want to do.
Yeah, which you don't want to do. Exactly. So yeah, there's like a little bit of mixing, but it's really native stuff. And once you get down just a couple inches, it's that really dark, spongy, organic, great wetland stuff. So we're George and I were talking about it, and we think that area might get inundated with water. Like it might actually become a basin that like holds water potentially permanently once the hydrology sort of fixes itself, but we're not sure. We won't know, of course, till it happens, but it's looking really promising basically. So yeah, so that's all I have for property.
I was going to say, in the proof of the pudding will be at least two seasons worth of growth.
Oh yeah,
see how well it does.
They're monitoring for three seasons.
Okay, good. Yeah, because sometimes people just want to. Okay, I planted it; it's all done. And it's like, well, no, because it doesn't always all take the first year.
Right. Yeah. So that's all I have for properties. I did just have a couple more quick things to say about non-property things I wanted to talk about. Kakiwick, I already really did.
So actually. before you go on to that, that's a whole separate agenda item. I wanted to backtrack to, hold on a second. Let me see where this went. A couple of things you and I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the trail, that nature trail for the gas station remediation on Route 6, Hop River Road.
Yes. So, sorry, go ahead. Oh,
no, nothing. I was just going to say that when we approved the plans, we had talked with the applicant about possibly putting in a connection to the rail trail, and and they say, oh, that's a good idea, and they never put it on the plans. And so never put it on the plans, and never had any drawings or whatever. It was just like an idea we discussed, and so they want to actually do something about it now with a street crossing. And so when I was talking to Alyssa about it, my thoughts were that it was an amendment to the application because it really wasn't on there, and they would need to come in with whatever proposal for stream crossing, et cetera, that they wanted to do.
Yeah, so I actually just today, I was talking to Patrice about it from Planning and Zoning. And because I was just sort of, I'm still confused kind of about the whole situation, because with P&Z, it was left very open-ended. So they didn't even have like a particular plan for the trail. The plan sort of happened when myself, Dave, and Patrice and the site contractor all walked would be the trail in the future. And so that, I think, was where I was confused. I figured that was sort of the approval, I guess. So, but yeah, I still have to talk to the site
contractor. That would just be a discussion of, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Why don't you proceed to the commission? They can't, right. They can't really just do it because you all thought it was a good idea out there. They have to formally modify the plan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, that was sort of,
So it would be just to let them know.
Right. Yeah.
The applicant, just so they don't get themselves into trouble if there was there was a misunderstanding with you and Patrice as to what constituted approval and the applicant was there. Right. I don't want to set them up to like, what the heck are you doing? And we sort of said you might be able to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So especially with the stream crossing, I think.
And it shouldn't be a big deal, but they should have some. Diane?
I was just going to say I'm on P&Z. Mm-hmm. So is that like a conflict of interest for me to hear any of that?
It's not a conflict of interest for you to hear about it. It would be a conflict of interest for you to, let's say, vote yes or no based on something you knew from P&Z as opposed to something you knew from Inland Wetlands.
Okay. I don't recall.
I'll give you an example. Say that somebody is building someplace and we think it's a good idea. It's okay from the inland wetlands perspective, but you know, P&Z would have heartburn about the location of the driveway because of traffic issues. And if you voted no, because you know that P&Z isn't going to like the position of the driveway because of traffic.
I wouldn't do that.
No, I'm just saying that's what would be inappropriate. But you also could suggest like, hey, I know that from P&Z, you might want to move the driveway. You know, that might be an okay suggestion because we certainly have made suggestions like that to folks that you might want to make sure you check with P&Z, which they have to anyway, know about certain things because it's, you know, looks good to us, but you really need to get the okay of, you know, P&Z after we're done.
Okay. Well, I haven't been on P&Z that long, so I don't recall any of the conversation about that anyway.
Yeah, just a good question to ask, but it's really just a matter of making sure which hat you're wearing when you rule, you know, and just, you know, be clear, state that, you know, like you did if you're on P&Z, and you can recuse yourself if you feel more comfortable doing that. But I think as long as you state what, you know, that the wetlands issues and, you know, discuss those, it's not really a conflict.
Okay.
But
thank
it's a good thing to bring up.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So yeah, basically I'm going to talk to Phil Shaddle. And yeah, I'm going to have to just tell him, hey, we need to amend this and actually get like a real plan, because it's very much just kind of by word of mouth and by a handshake right now, which I did think was odd, but it seems that zoning, that's how they were preferring it. They weren't mandating any specific trail or anything like that. So they just said a trail.
Well, they would be fine with it from their perspective because it benefits, it's a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. And they may not have P&Z issues, but we have wetlands issues. So that's why they're two separate commissions.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, especially with the stream crossing, I do think we need to kind of have our hand in it a little more than we do right now.
Yeah.
Anything else, Ross?
Yes, and you and I also talked about One Notch Road. That was for reactivating the gravel pit down at the end of Notch Road to do some filling and grading in there to make it storage location for equipment and for stockpiles of gravel and sand and possibly doing a little bit of processing.
Right.
The owner is not going to complete that work. He has the lot up for sale.
Yeah, so we were wondering if it was stabilized as is.
Yeah, so we would need to make sure that what he has done there is in a stable condition so it doesn't cause any issues while it's sitting there. So I don't know whether there's, you know, erosion control measures that need to be put in place, whether, you know, or what.
Okay, perfect.
Would he have to finish, would he have to complete work such that there's no temporary controls in place? Because once he sells the property, we can't enforce maintenance of those temporary controls on the new owner, could we?
Well, the permit goes with the property.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yes.
So hopefully the new owner is aware of that when they buy.
Yeah, but it would be good for him to do something that's not more or less permanent.
Yeah.
Because you don't know when the new person is going to... when and if there's going to be a new owner and what they want to do with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as long as he has like stable stone dikes and stuff, but not necessarily hay bales or silt fence.
Yeah, wouldn't be good. The state DOT had an interest in that place to reconfigure the exit and entrance to Notch Road.
Yeah.
And when he bought the place, we had said, you really want to do that? Because there were some plans to reconfigure, you know, that and a Notch Road.
Yeah,
I've heard that maybe that's no longer a plan of DOT, but it's just like, whatever.
It's probably a plan of DOT, but it could be buried behind a ton of other plans.
Yeah. So whatever, it just would be good for him to make sure it's stabilized. And the other reason to do so is there's an interested party who lives nearby who associates any runoff on the road in that area with the work that the current owner is doing. And when I've gone down there with Cam to look at the stuff after the, you know, this person complains, Cam and I go and look, and most of it is just crap that washes down the hill through the existing culvert that's on the side of, you know, Notch Road down there. It's just, you know, the way the road was engineered, it's just a ditch, basically. And when you get a lot of rain, it washes the leaves off it, and any other cover exposes dirt and washes it out into Notch Road with some of those intense rains that we've had. And then that empties across the other side of Notch Road into, I don't know whether it's an existing wetlands or a retention basin that's by Notch Road Extension. And that's got a lot of sedimentation in it. And this person was concerned that it was coming from Notch, you know, One Notch Road. And there's so much stuff in there. It's all just years of stuff that's washed down Notch Road. You know, every time there's a rainstorm, it's sand from when they sand the roads in the winter. It's really nothing to do with One Notch Road, but just it's a good thing just that we keep on top of it, just because there is a party who is, we should do it anyway, but there's also a party that would raise some concerns, and we should be on top of that.
I have a question about that too, though. What about the property underneath that bridge? What's down there that would impact our commission and Lynn Wetlands? Because there's that bridge that goes right over into onto 384, but underneath, that's pretty high. So what's
that's the Hop River Trail runs under there.
Okay. So there's no problem with anything going on above
the way
it?
The way that the property is like a little bit of a basin, and there's the low point of that basin is towards the gate where you enter and exit the property, Notch Road, One Notch Road.
Uh-huh. So
there really isn't any issue that I can see and Cam could see from anything running off down into the Hop River Trail. It's okay. Just more of stuff washing out onto Notch Road if you get a really heavy downpour.
Okay.
But the owner had done some work to make, you know, that Cam and I had discussed with putting in some water bars and putting in a drainage pipe and doing some other stuff that, you know, took care of any issues that, you know, Cam saw.
Okay.
But it wouldn't hurt to revisit it since it is for sale. And to, you know, your point, Michael, I don't want to stick a new owner with a problem. It would be better to have it, you know, taken care of before the new owner gets it.
Yeah, so, yeah, first things on my list after this meeting for the end of this week and next are 271 Hop River and One Notch. I'll figure out what's going on with those. So,
yep.
Okay.
Awesome. So, anything else for us?
Nope.
Okay. So, yeah, I had in my agent report to talk about Kakiwik, but I pretty much already did with everyone except Ross, and Ross was there. So, that was in my report.
Since that was before the meeting officially started, you should probably talk about it now.
Okay. Kakiwik was fantastic. As everybody knows, I had a lovely time. I did the sort of wetland agent regulatory track. Learned a ton.
I was going to say the attendees were Michael and yes. Alyssa and...
Yeah. Myself, Ross Alley, and Michael McDonald.
Barbara Kelly was there.
Kelly was there. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it was great. I learned a lot about the statute, even though sometimes I think I've already read through it 150 times and there's not much more I can glean from it. It's mm-hmm. a living document. There is, frankly, a lot of subjectivity with it. That's why we exist. So I guess that's kind of interesting. But I just learned a lot about the regulations, about how enforcement works. It was fantastic. It was a great event.
And we got one handout that I thought was good that described the escalation sequence for when you get, you know, a violation. And I should make a copy of that and send it out to the commission, because that's kind of the guidelines I'm, you know, is going by when you and I talked about how to approach, you know, a violation is... Right. You start out nice and you turn up the heat, and where you start depends on how serious the violation is.
Yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I know y'all won't be able to read much of this, but you can see how many just margin notes I took. Mm-hmm. This was one of the workshops. I believe it was the first workshop in the series, and it was called All Things Vegetated Considered. It was run by this fantastic land use attorney who's been in the business for decades, won a ton of like landmark wetlands cases, Janet Brooks. And so just sort of learning about how to regulate vegetation removal, because it's not the typical like someone's putting up a building or someone's building a pool. It's sort of a little bit different than what we might typically see. There was also a section that was just a Q&A session with the attorney Brooks, as well as another very important sort of landmark decision making land use judge who has been in the business for many decades as well. That was Judge Berger, I believe his name was. That was very, very helpful.
I will scan that document and send it out to the commission.
Perfect. Yeah. So yeah, it was just sort of that question and answer session was really helpful, because it was, there were probably a couple hundred people in the crowd, and it was, a lot of them were commission members. Some were agents, staff like myself. And, it was just a way for people to really directly speak to the people that sort of make these decisions. and the people that know this statue best. So it was, someone was able to say like, oh, this specific instance happened in my town. How would you handle this? And they just got some really good guidance from that, that they might not have thought of before. Yeah. So this, I guess I can start talking about this now. It sort of comes from Kakiwik, the buffer thing that I just sort of want to.
Oh yeah.
If I can just jump in real quick, one thing I found at Kakiwak that was really useful, the Yukon Clear Table was selling a manual, and I haven't read it full through yet, but it's a great manual that it's, actually I'll share my screen. Let me know when people can see it.
Yeah. Okay.
If you just search Yukon Clear, brings you to their website. And it's the Center for Land Use Education and Research. And you scroll down, and over here, what's legally required? You can click on that, and you can purchase that book. It's What's Legally Required, A Guide to Legal Rules for Making Local Land Use Decisions in the State of Connecticut. It's a very good manual. It takes the legalese talk of the statute and translates it into something that's much more understandable. And not only that, it covers all the legal requirements, and as far as public hearing procedure, public notice, receiving application, everything you would need to know from a legal standpoint, and a meeting standpoint for running a wetland, stuff that I've been picking up just listening to Ross, but this is all in a document. And it also covers other land use decision bodies like PNZ and stuff, and how they can tie together and everything, how sometimes our reviews are tied into it also, PNZ or a zoning ruling. And so it's a great book. It's a great reference. You know, obviously I'm not going to sit down and read it all at once, but I'll glance through it and know where, kind of learn where everything is. And it's a great reference to go back to without having to dive into the statutes. Cause when you go into the statutes, you'll go through a paragraph or two, and then it'll reference six other sections of the statute. And then you're going back and forth, you know, trying to keep it all straight in your head. Whereas this book sums everything up in a nice, neat, understandable fashion for non-lawyers. So
did you purchase it?
I purchased it there. Yep. And you can either purchase an online copy and get an electronic copy, or they'll, you can purchase the hard copy like I did, and they will mail it to you.
I wonder if we could get it to in our library, in the Bolton Library somehow.
That's certainly possible. I would imagine.
So I just clicked on the link and it says, sorry, you've reached the page that is not available.
Oh, no. Interesting. Yeah, because I bought it at the site. Let me see if I have any better luck.
Because it says click here to purchase. So I did, and not happening.
Huh.
Because I was just going to say you could probably get that reimbursed.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There's an 8th edition.
Yeah, then you scroll down, and then when you click here to purchase.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say, let me see if there's an email. I would say I would email them and ask how I go about purchasing.
No, because it sounds very good, because what I've picked up may not always be accurate over the years. So it's good, better to your point, to have a document like this that we can have to refer to.
Yep.
It might even have it at Amazon too.
Oh, that's possible. And there's a phone number you can call that at the bottom of the webpage, and an email address. So
it also says UConn. Maybe you could get it at UConn College.
That's possible.
It's through in their bookstore.
Yep. So
all sorts of possibilities.
Yep. So it's a, I think I found it to be a very useful book. And
yeah, that's great.
Interesting.
Did you have anything you wanted to add, Ross?
No, I was more interested in, you know, what you and Michael had as takeaways, because I've been going to this thing for years. And I, like I said, I usually go to the legal part of it. And the other thing that they did mention, too, was to help people, well, take advantage of people who want to do some clearing when it involves invasive species. So that, let's say that they come in for a jurisdictional ruling, they want to get rid of some bittersweet or some stuff like that, autumn olive, other things that might be considered invasive. You know, take advantage of that. And, you know, and that some of this could be permitted as of right under use and maintenance of their property, with a proviso that they're not doing a lot of disturbing of the soil. They're not grubbing to get, you know, get stuff out, you know, where they create an erosion problem, but, you know, work with people to take advantage of opportunities to get rid of invasives. And also maybe help them, because sometimes they don't know that in Japanese knotweed and stuff like that, you'd leave any little fragments of the roots, they can all grow. So they may think they're doing something to clear up stuff, and they're really just helping spread it. So that's one of the things they did mention, which is also funny, because I was at the Republican Town Committee meeting last night, and one of our members asked me a question, like, what would the, you know, Inland Wetlands think if I wanted to get rid of a bunch of Phragmites on my property? And I said, why don't we talk about it or come to the commission, because we just had a workshop at a conference that talked about, you know, that. So some of this, you know, you might, they want to do it because they want to make the place look a little better, but we also can take advantage of it by using use and maintenance and enjoyment of their property as, you know, to help move it along, as opposed to requiring a permit or whatever. Again, it's all caveated with how do they want to go about it? And, you know, if it's just simply clearing and maybe you put down some plastic to smother the stuff, that's one thing. If you want to go on a steep slope and remove some invasive, and then it's, you know, maybe an invasive, but it is serving a purpose of holding, you know, slope in place. And if you remove it, you created a new problem. So just thought I would, that was the other one that I hadn't really thought of, but it, you know, made sense when, you know, they brought it up in the workshop. You know, just to take advantage of these opportunities.
Definitely. Sort of in that same vein of like generally educating the public, Ross had the idea of, and I had also been sort of thinking about a way to do this, creating a sort of brochure for to keep in my office, to keep you know, at the front desk of land use, to maybe even mail out, to just sort of give people a general overview of what a wetland is. When do you call the agent? What are some general signs that you may have a wetland? So I've been working on designing that, and it's coming along really nicely. I can definitely share that. Probably next meeting would be good. And yeah, so just to kind of, because I mean, 99% of the time, folks don't even know they have wetlands on their properties, which is sort of a problem in itself. But I think a little bit of education could go a really long way in, you know, people dumping brush, dumping grass clippings, doing things like that in their wetlands. So yeah, that's another little thing.
So I just went to Amazon, getting back to what's legally required. I think you could did a good thing buying a copy while you were there, Michael, because Amazon doesn't have it in stock. Currently unavailable, we don't know when or if this item will be back in stock. And, oh, wow. And it says it's published by the Connecticut DEEP.
I guess they must have sold a ton of them at the CACUWAC conference.
Yeah, true. And ran out through all the copies of it.
Yeah.
Sold out.
Because there's another good book that if you ever come across a copy of it, buy it. It's called The Face of Connecticut, and that's a really good book, too. I happen to have a hard copy of it. It's no longer in print. You can get a PDF version of it. It's a combination of the geographical story of Connecticut and the history of Connecticut. So it goes back to where all the different pieces of Connecticut came from in Pangaea, how they all came together, what happened during the ice ages, and then it goes into what happened while the Native Americans were here before the settlers, and then what the settlers did to the state. It's very well written. It's a really enjoyable read, and it gives you a good feeling for, like, why you got all those stone walls in the middle of the woods? Because at one point, 95% of Connecticut was stripped of all the trees, and it was all agricultural except for industrial sites. And then after the Civil War, farming declined and all the forests came back. And that's why you have all these, you know, stone walls in the middle of nowhere. So it's very interesting because it covers like the geopolitical history. So it's quite, it's really a fascinating book. Very.
Who's the author?
I can't remember. It's a guy, a man, and I can't remember his name, but I can go take a look. It's on my bookshelf downstairs.
Okay. It's
called The Face of Connecticut. They think you can get PDF versions of it online as well. Some nice souls have made copies of it, whether they were supposed to or not, and the PDF is available. And again, it's nothing to do with law or any of that stuff, but it just gives you a good background and perspective of how did we get to where we are, you know, here from the geological and historical perspective.
Interesting.
That sounds great.
It does.
So I think I will go end up calling UConn tomorrow and seeing if they got a copy of some more copies of this. We do have plenty of money left in our budget, so I might be able to get some copies for the commission and expense them. But I would suggest, Michael, you go and expense your copy.
Okay.
And if you could just send, you sent in your, did you send your request for reimbursement to Danielle?
Not yet. So I'll just do that all together.
Well, yes.
Separate requests, but at the same time.
Yeah, just do them. Yeah, do it to Hirsch because she takes care of submitting them to finance.
Okay, very good.
And if she needs an approval from me for the book, you know, she'll let me know, or you can. But I don't see where it's. I think it's a legitimate expense, and I think it would the members of the commission be interested if I can get a copy?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm just looking.
I think we should have a copy.
Yes, I think it would be good because it's part of our education and training, and we have over $1,000 left in the budget right now, and I can't imagine we're going to spend it all by next June, the end of June. So, all right, let me make a note to do that.
Great.
They had one copy of The Face of Connecticut on Amazon, and I just bought it.
Oh, good.
Oh.
But don't anybody else try. It must have been under the used book section.
Probably, yeah.
Because it's no longer in print.
Wow.
I think I got mine at...
Unless I just bought it from you, Ross.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember where the heck I bought that copy. And I think it was either at a land trust meeting or land trust conference or a CACUWAC conference, but I know I bought it at something in some environmental conference.
And you can't buy it now at all?
Oh, obviously Michael managed to get it, so.
Well, it was one copy left, so it was just mostly luck.
I would say 99.9%.
Yeah.
Gosh, so was it a soft cover?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's what I have is the soft cover up, but you'll enjoy the read.
Great. Look forward to it.
So anything else about CACUWAC? Because I think we beat that one to death with a stick. Not that it was a wrong topic.
The only thing I would say is if you have a streamer in your property, buy flood insurance. Even if you're not in the floodplain, designated floodplain, get flood insurance.
And install a riparian buffer if you don't have one already.
Why are you saying that? Is that
the flood insurance or the buffer?
Both.
The flood insurance, because the flood maps are incredibly inaccurate. As some folks on who lost the culvert like a year ago or so learned, you can still get, you know, this is streaming in your backyard, and especially if climate change keeps giving us more and more rain, you can get flood and you get flood damage, and your insurance company will say, sorry, not our problem.
Yeah, I think, to your point, because I think a lot of people look and say, oh, that imaginary line going through my yard is a hard and fast boundary, and I'm 1 inch on this side of it, and I am safe. They don't know that it's a plus or minus band that happens to be in the middle of.
It's all based on probabilistic models. And so, and so, I mean, like, if you're high and dry, you're nowhere near a stream, which I know my house is that case. So I'm not concerned about it, but if there's a nice little babbling brook in your backyard.
Yeah.
It can well, be I have a culvert that runs under my driveway. I'll have to have Alyssa come out because there's a culvert on either side.
Well, if it's a culvert just for storm rain, for the drive, you know, storm runoff from the road, that I wouldn't be too concerned.
Well, that's but not it, though.
She's at the foot of Wall Street, too. So really steep hill. So
Yeah,
but if you have a stream or a water course in your property, it you might want, you know, it's the great, you know, the contours of your property, too. But you might want to look into it and then the nice thing is it may not be designated floodplain, but if it's not a designated floodplain, your insurance premiums are comparatively cheap compared to someone who actually lives in a designated floodplain. So
that's very interesting. You should say that because there is on to the right of the driveway. It's always wet over there.
Yeah.
Like wet. You can see water.
Yeah, you know, I can't sit here on a Zoom meeting and say who should have flood insurance and who should not. But
no, I know, but that's why it's
something you may want to. If you think there's a possibility, you may want to seek some advice.
Yeah, because everything is, the theme of this is that there is climate change, whether you think it's human caused or not. There is something going on, and you need to be prepared to deal with it. You know, regardless of what the cause is.
Yep.
And things are basically getting more severe, and we're getting more rain, but it's not necessarily spread out evenly. As you can see, we had a lot this spring. We've had no rain for almost 3 months now.
Yep.
And now we have some storms coming up, you know, over the next couple of weeks. So it's like, it's the whole, everything, the patterns of it all are changing. And it's just basically more variability and greater intensity with an average increase in warmth, even though, you know, like a few years ago, my house looked like it was in the middle of Maine. I had snow up to my windowsills in the front yard. And, you know, it was really, really cold. It reminded me more of back, like when I was a kid back in the, you know, 60s or 70s, when before the weather really started to dramatically change. And now you look out there and it's nothing. And, you know, the last year we had next to no snow. So it's just very unpredictable.
Well, that's partially my fault because I bought a new snow thrower. So that could be part of the reason.
Well, that's why I bought my first one. My first 2 years of living here, we just had mild snow. And it was fun taking a snow shovel out. It's my first house, you know. And I just said, oh, it's fun. I can bond with my driveway. I'll shovel it. And then my friend Paul, whose son-in-law is a weatherman, is the chief weather meteorologist at Channel 8 in New Haven, said, there's going to be like 2 feet of snow coming. And I suddenly was not that interested in just using a shovel and bought my snowblower. I got whatever price could sell me that was with the back of my car and get home by, you know, the day before the storm.
Well, but maybe I'll be inviting Alyssa over to see my culverts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we could, I'd just like to segue over to the budget.
Sure.
And let me share my screen this time. And folks, see the screen?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the budget worksheet that I got from Kathy McCavanaugh, who's the administrative assistant for the selectmen and for the town administrator. And I'm suggesting that for our budget for 25 to 26, just we keep the same budget. We've had the same one pretty much for 10 years or more now. And we usually only send, despite increases in inflation and such, we still typically only spend about half to two thirds of it. So my suggestion would be to just keep the budget the same as previously,
mm-hmm.
unless anybody thinks otherwise. I just don't see any need to increase it unless, you know, just tell you what we base it on is we base it on having a meeting every month, which we don't always have because, you know, and then we also base it on, I think, two public hearings. And then we assume that there's all the that associated with those two public hearings and those 12 monthly meetings, there's a certain amount of notifications and postings we have to do in the newspapers. And so that's what this is all, you know, it's all based on. And dues and fees, that's pretty much our membership for CACUIC. And then we have professional education and training. And, you know, at the end of the day, if we spend a little bit, payroll is also for our clerk. And at the end of the day, we wind up transferring a little bit of money from one account to another, if, you know, depending on how it goes. But I would just say leave it this. My recommendation would be to leave it the same unless anybody disagrees with that. I know, Jim, you've been with us the longest. What would you think?
Keep it the same.
And I'm just looking at our actual expenditures for payroll, and we are a little less than halfway through the year and have spent close to all of the money in there. Would it make any sense to say move any from advertising over or just wait and see what happens when we do the budget for next year?
I'd say wait and see.
Yeah, none of the other categories got pinched or came close, so. Yeah, I wait and see.
Wait and see, yeah.
All right. So then I will entertain a motion to approve a 2025 to fiscal year 25 to 26 budget that is the same as the current fiscal year's budget.
So moved.
So Jim, you made the motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Second by Diane. Any further discussion? Then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Then the proposed budget passes by recommendation by all members of the commission present. So we can go on to the other topic, which is the updates to the wetland regs.
Yeah.
Still a work in progress. I got some information I needed this weekend at CACUAC, so I'll be able to incorporate that. And I'm still doing some work on trying to come up with good numbers for permitting costs and, you know, basically the stuff in the appendix. So
yeah.
I'm hoping to, I've been flat out with other things since the end of CACUAC, but hopefully this week I'll be able to start piecing it together, and I hope to get everyone a copy before Thanksgiving, and
cool.
Which will give everyone plenty of time to look at before the next meeting.
Thank you, sir. And one thing we did learn was that I don't think we can expect much help from DEEP, because no. We used to have Darcy Winther was our contact there. She used to have three or four people working in her office. She left that position over 2 years ago, and there's been some alleged transition going on. Mm-hmm. And no one would answer Michael's simple question about how long does a permit last? And the woman who is allegedly taking over from Darcy, but still not fully, and doesn't have any timetable for completion of that transition, said like she wants to say soon, but she was told not to to under promise and over deliver, and Darcy's over there nodding. So it sounds like you can't even answer a simple question like that. You know,
the good thing is I got a good answer to that question. A lady from the Thompson Inland Wetland Committee. It was nice enough to come over, and
yes,
she went through the same trials and tribulations I did trying to read the statues, and she finally got the answer she was looking for. So I'll be able to copy and paste, portions of theirs that are applicable to ours.
Yeah, I was wondering who that was, because I saw you talking to her, and afterwards she says, "Never mind, I got the answer." Yeah, I don't know what's going on, but I do know that for whatever reason, over the years since the Malloy administration, they've been cutting back on the support to various wetland commissions. And it's just, the thing I would compare it to is like, if the registrars work with the Secretary of State, they have a staff that really is very supportive. You have lawyers you can talk to and get answers for. They're assigned a segment of the state. DEEP used to have something similar for Inland Wetlands Commission. It's all gone. And I don't know why it's one thing they talk about being, supporting the environment and such, and then they don't really. And so more to come on that, but it sounds like we're more or less on our own, unfortunately, except for the benefit of organizations like Hackiwick and some others that, can help us out with stuff. So that's the part I did find, was frustrating.
And that's another great benefit of Hackiwick, is you can network out to other inland wetland agencies from other towns. And that's very useful for information. And like the lady from Thompson was very helpful for us. So another benefit of Hackiwick.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you couldn't make it this year, I'd suggest for next year.
Absolutely.
And I don't know how long Hackiwick's going to be on, because we're looking at their financial statements and they're losing money.
Didn't look good.
Like another professional organization I belong to, that I looked at our local chapter's budget, and it's like the Project Management Institute, and I'm looking like, okay, how much do we have in assets and how much are you behind? And I said, we're going to be gone in 3 or 4 years. Are you guys going to do anything about it? Yeah. But,
when they have chicken McNuggets for lunch, we know something's not good.
So at the very least, come for the food. They have a good spread. The location is really wonderful, too. So anything else folks want to go over? Otherwise, I will wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll have our Christmas party online at our next meeting.
Wait, sorry, everyone. Everyone just got excited to leave. I had two more things I wanted to discuss.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
No one did the motion to adjourn yet. So I guess.
Okay, good. So it's just two things that I've sort of learned about in the last week or so that I don't know if this is something that would belong in the regulations. I don't know if this is just something we want to adopt generally as a commission. But the first one is, I was speaking to another wetland agent, and she was telling me how they put, they make their folks put up a sort of marker for delineated wetlands, which I hadn't heard about in Bolton, but this was in Summers, and they will have, once work is finished, they'll have the resident put up, like, for example, like a lally column filled with concrete with sort of a wetlands like seal epoxied to it, so that, if the property gets transitioned over to someone else, they will know that there's wetlands there. And I just thought that was a good idea. I don't know if we do
something. I'm just wondering, Jim, did we do that on one of those properties off Loomis, that development there, which was done along a stream or wetlands? I thought some couple of places we may have done that, or we've asked, may have done something with marking it with boulders or some such thing on some properties. I seem to have a memory. We've not consistent.
Something with BLT. I don't know. BLT did some markers like that, but it's nothing we ever really did consistently.
Yeah. BLT is Bolton Land Trust.
Yeah. Yeah. That was just something that I thought might be a good idea because I'm going out to these properties that Barb has already been out to, that others have already been out to, and all I have is sort of an inaccurate online wetland map. The land files will sometimes have a wetland line, but it's just, we don't really have anything centralized. And I think the best way would be to put something permanent down. Now, I'm not saying like every little project that comes through, we make them put down a granite something to mark out the wetlands. But on these bigger projects, like for example, 148 Brandy Street, I think it would have been a good idea to have him sort of delineate the wetlands, just put like a column or two and say, these are wetlands.
Even just like the steel pipes, like surveyors use, right.
Put a exactly.
couple of those in. It doesn't have to be fancy to your point, but it would be something right. that you could always point to if there was an issue, and it would be on the plan too. So if you go out there and you're looking at the plan and there's suddenly no more of these pipes there, then that's a little bit of a problem too.
Yeah. Just something permanent or, you know, reasonably permanent that, you know, when people move, you know, there's wetlands here. When the agent comes out, even if it hasn't been marked on the land files or online, they know there's been delineated wetlands here. So I think that could be something that we could implement. Like I said, I don't know if that would go in regs or if we would just sort of start implementing that. The other thing to that effect is this has been sort of something that's become very important to me as I'm learning about wetlands more and more, and it's buffers. So I started out my wetland work in Massachusetts, where every town pretty much has a prohibitive buffer. I don't know if there's a statewide one yet, but every single town pretty much has at least like a 15-foot buffer. Sometimes they're up to 50, depending on the town. And this is basically just a buffer that's non-disturbed. The folks can't touch it. Like nothing can happen to it. So this is an issue because we can't just put like a blanket buffer over our town. Like we can't say you can't use 25 feet of your yard because that would be considered a taking. So
planning and zoning can do it, but
inland wetlands can't. Right. Exactly. So that to me, through my work and my research and just experience with this, you can make the upland review area, you can increase that, you can, you know, there's certain things we can do within our power that's easy that makes protection of wetlands easier. You can make the upland review area 200 feet, you can make it 1,000 feet. In my opinion, you could make it 1,000,000 feet, and it doesn't really protect the wetlands. All it does is put more burden on town staff, really, because even if it's in the upland review area, it's not likely to get denied. And what I think the only thing that truly protects the wetlands and the most effective thing to not only protect the wetlands, but also provide flood mitigation, erosion control, stream cooling, habitat. I mean, they have countless features, and that's buffers. So I think as a commission, I really think we should focus our efforts on wherever we can put a condition on permits to either maintain a buffer that exists or plant a buffer that's not there already. I really want to encourage us to do that because I think that is probably the single best thing we can do to protect the wetlands. And it is, you know, people want to grade directly up to their wetlands and they don't see a point in leaving part of their land unused. They want to use every bit of it, but I think we really should focus on our efforts on implementing buffers. And these would be on a case-by-case basis. So if someone has a small yard, they're going to do a 10-foot buffer. But if someone's doing a massive subdivision, they're going to have a 50-foot buffer, that sort of thing. So just what we deem to be what's best to protect the wetlands most effectively. I think we really need to focus.
I think we would need to avoid use of, I'm not saying not to do it. We have to think about how we would do it where you yes. don't use the term buffer.
Right.
And you keep the conversation related to mitigating impacts of the development on the property, and ways that you do that is to leave certain areas undisturbed, whether you're leaving trees in to shade the water to maintain temperature, whether mm-hmm. you're leaving some, we have done this in the past though, some lake developments where it's yeah. a new house going in, we require them not to clear to the edge of the water,
yeah,
you know, to help control, you know, which gets hard because you look at their place and like the neighbors on each side have gone and cleared it right to the water. But that was done mm-hmm. before, you know, we had a better idea of what happened, you know, the cumulative impacts of doing that.
Yeah.
So I think it's doable. I agree with you. It's something to keep in mind. We just have to avoid the use of buffer right. and keep it, the conversation focused on what's necessary to prevent or mitigate impacts to that site because of the activities proposed for that site.
Correct.
I know
and how do we do that? How do we start doing that?
It's a medication. It's a medication that we use as a condition for approval of a permit.
Yeah, so it would yeah. be a condition. So I learned at CACUIC, well, I knew this before, I guess, but so basically our jurisdiction, we can't talk about wetlands in the sense of habitat. Like we can't, all of those sort of fluffy, really great reasons for wetlands, but mm-hmm. but sort of not super direct, I guess. I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but those reasons like habitat, food for wildlife, things like that.
Statutes have no reference to wildlife.
To anything like that. Right. So all we can do is what physically affects, makes physical changes to the wetlands. So sediment deposit, temperature change, things that physically impact, like in a measurable way, impact the wetlands physically.
There was a case decision a few years ago, which came up in CACUIC, where they mentioned too, like, let's say that you see a spotted salamander.
Yeah.
They typically travel several hundred yards to spawn. Mm-hmm. And they hibernate over the winter and live, you know, quite a distance from water. And if you see them on your property in an uplands area, you know that they're going down to that swamp, and you know that they're a species of concern, and you know that if you put this development here, they're not going to have a way to get to the water anymore, and they're not going to mm-hmm. be able to breathe. And mm-hmm. yet that's not a reason for asking for things not to be, you know, to be done to protect them.
Yeah.
However, there was a case decided where there was a spotted salamander population that needed to be able to get to a wetlands to spawn. And they successfully argued based on scientific evidence that if you prevented these amphibians from getting to the water, the tadpoles from them would not spawn in the water. They would not eat the leaf litter. They would not do all the other little things that these tadpoles would do, their larval stage of the salamander would do. And because of that, the quality of the wetland would decline. And so they wound up being able to protect the spotted mm-hmm. salamander's ability to get to the water because they showed a definite link to water quality and the quality of the wetlands because of the salamander. So there's ways that you can do this that have a legitimate scientific reason for them, but you can't directly do it to protect the animal for its own sake. You have to protect the animal because it helps maintain the wetlands. So it's kind of the opposite.
Gosh, yeah, you're maintaining, it you're, so you're, hard.
You're protecting the wetland, and a secondary benefit of that is the species.
Correct.
Also.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So you kind of turn it around from, you know, like the animal has its own worth to, it has a value to protect the wet, you know, to maintain the quality of the wetlands.
Yeah.
So there's ways to do it and, you know, to be aware of. Because most people don't think about it, because there's a lot of amphibians and other creatures like that that need the water for a certain time of the year, and the rest of the year you don't even ever associate them with that wetlands because you will never easily see them there, but there's that link.
Well, that's why people don't know about things, because they don't understand the process of all these animals and how they live and how important it is for all of them to survive.
Yeah, so there's ways to be creative and respect people's rights to develop while you're also doing a little more to protect the overall environment.
Right.
Pay
Because,
paradise to put in a parking lot.
So, I mean, a lot of this comes down to like, one little development along a pond is not going to make any difference, and you have to look at each one of these. And then, but by the time you put developments all the way around the pond, you've basically killed it. Even though not one of those, housing developments on its own was the death knell, it's the cumulative impact. And so that gets back to also working with planning and zoning and some other areas to kind of look at it holistically for a town watershed or whatever. But it's a lot, and we're not going to solve it tonight, but it's just something to be aware of.
Yeah, I agree. We won't solve it tonight. I think because all of this is so interconnected, I think I have faith that we will always be able to figure out a way to connect that buffer back to being able to physically protect the wetlands, because buffers will always physically protect wetlands. There's countless reasons. We basically just have to find them, and we
Don't
need to make sure that as a
call them
commission,
buffers.
not buffers.
Undisturbed, undisturbed areas. Maybe
Undisturbed
they're
area.
undisturbed because they had some conversations about that too, with definitions to be careful, because you might
Yeah,
want to
like
disturb an area
natural.
because it's got invasives in it.
Right.
But they had ways to word it, that would be good.
Yeah,
Without
undisturbed areas. So
calling it a buffer.
leaving, yeah, exactly. So leaving undisturbed areas around these wetlands. And I think there's gonna be ways that we can find that they will protect the wetlands physical
Oh,
structure, because
in the legitimate
they
way.
do.
It's not doing this
Absolutely.
to like play games with people. It's a legitimate fact that,
It is. We just have to find it and bring it to them, because I feel like it's an education thing.
and have a
Yes.
scientific explanation for it.
Exactly. It
Expert
is an education thing.
Right.
Yeah,
So, yeah, I
I'm
just,
all for that. I'm all
yeah,
for that.
absolutely. And that
Yeah,
also,
I
we talk
think.
about the education too. That's also with our Conservation Commission, because that's more of their focus too, is the
Yeah.
education and education and advocacy, whereas we tend to be more enforcement.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah,
The
so.
gentleman who came to speak, I don't know where we were, but he was amazing on the conversation Conservation Committee chairperson. He was really a good speaker, and I learned a lot from him. I don't know where we were. We were at some kind of meeting in town, but he was very, very good.
Okay. Anything else?
I don't think so. I think that's
Also,
everything for me. It was just the possibly permanently delineating things with a structure and turning our focus to buffers
and
with
how
locations.
quickly can we
Not buffers,
enforce
undisturbed areas.
undisturbed areas? How quickly can we enforce the undisturbed areas? Like, can we just start
Start with
doing
our
that?
next
Yeah, with our next application.
application.
Yeah,
It
it's just gonna
might
have to
be
be
good to
something.
mention it in our regs in some way,
Right.
I was
so
gonna
that
ask
we have
that.
something to fall back on, as opposed to having to every single time get an expert. Well, you wouldn't need to get an expert. There has to be a scientifically demonstrated reason for doing it. And it would be good to have it in our regs, because if it's not in the regs and you try to do it, even if it's the right thing, it makes it harder, and it's less, less likelihood it would stand up to legal challenge.
Yeah, we can work on that then, sort of putting some language together to maybe define an undisturbed area and, I don't know, list some of the benefits. I'm not sure.
And also possibly talking to P&Z.
Yeah.
So that might be something good to do because they're the ones who have the ability. And I think we do have some buffers around key watershed areas in Bolton already. We'd have to check, but I think we may.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think like what Mansfield did with the 50 foot, people were thinking it was a 50 foot buffer, but it really isn't. It's just that anything within 50 feet triggers a significant impact, which means a public hearing. And I think, you know, it's a good step in the right direction, but I still just think that sort of just puts more burden on staff and on the commission.
What's a burden if you make it automatic regardless of the circumstances?
Right.
Doesn't make sense because it's a burden on me. I think it's also an unnecessary burden on the applicant that sort of makes us look like little bureaucrats and stuff, you know, not looking at the individual circumstances, but we can work on
it. Yeah, I agree. So yeah, I think placing undisturbed areas in our conditions for as many projects as we can and as require it. Obviously for a really simple little pre-built shed, we don't need them to put in a buffer, but for ground disturbance, I think undisturbed areas being left is critical in this day and age with all of this flooding happening. It helps the property owner at the end of the day, really. So, but yeah, I just wanted to bring that to our attention as a commission. That's sort of been the thing that I've really been gung-ho on recently, because I think it's the single best way to protect wetlands. So yeah, thanks for
that's great. For listening. Yeah, I think that's really, really important. Great. I'm all Thank for you. That.
Awesome. Great. I'm glad we're all on the same page, folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Anything else from anybody else? Mm-hmm. Then I will thank everybody and wish you all a happy, enjoyable Thanksgiving. And we'll, like I said, do our online Thanksgiving, our online Christmas party at our next meeting. And I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move to adjourn.
Second?
A second.
Okay, then I will say we're adjourned as of 8:39. All right.
All right.
Okay. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy
good Thanksgiving, everyone. Right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I've been on Zoom. Oh, I can't get off though.
I'm going to go on the Amazon. I bet I could get a radio on the Amazon. I've been to it. He's too busy.